Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. As always, I appreciate you joining me for a few minutes twice a week as we continue to mine the gold, and not just Topps gold, but plenty of other gold from the 1980s and 1990s in this big monster box as we have done this over the last few months. We've had a lot of fun with it, not only looking back at some great players from that era, some not so great players, or maybe some players you didn't even know made it in the major leagues, and of course looking back at some memorable for many different reasons card sets from that time. We are knee-deep in 1992. I was just looking over the list of sets that I have, and yeah, there's a lot from 1992. So we move forward after looking at Donruss Triple Play earlier in this week. We take a look at the base set for Donruss in 1992, the year that the Donruss set finally grew up into adulthood, but was it able to keep up with the competition? And I've said this before, 1992 was the year that everybody finally got caught up to Upper Deck, or at least tried to, with Upper Deck setting the curve in 1989. And some companies did it very well, others not so much. And you can look back at these cards 25 years later and have that debate. Now, we'll talk a little bit about the 92 Donruss set in a little bit. And our random pull from Series 1 of that year's set, card number 393, Juan Gonzalez. Then with the Texas Rangers, most commonly associated with the Texas Rangers. He did play for a few other teams in his career. But I've always appreciated Juan Gonzalez. And I've said before in some other podcasts that when I was a teenager, I was in a Boy Scout troop that would often go down to Port Charlotte, Florida. And we would be the color guard at a Texas Rangers spring training game or a minor league game. They had their advanced A team. The Charlotte Rangers were there for several years. So, I got to take a look at the Texas Rangers players and the team a lot more than most people did, because the Rangers for most of this time were a good, but definitely not a great team. In fact, they hadn't even made the playoffs at this point in time. They wouldn't make the playoffs until 1995. And of course, they've been in a couple of World Series since then, and they are a contender. But back in the early 90s, Texas was kind of that C-plus team. They weren't terrible, but they certainly weren't great, and they weren't on the national radar. And of course, back then with only four playoff teams, you know, two division winners from each league, even if a team like Texas won 88, 89 games, which might get you a wild card now, it didn't get you into the postseason. And Juan Gonzalez was one of my favorite players who unfortunately had a pretty tragic career, not like death in the family type stuff, but very similar to former teammate Jose Canseco, a guy who had a pretty interesting, challenging upbringing, was blessed with some incredible talent, but allegedly let it all go to waste via steroids. So we'll talk a little bit about Juan Gonzalez and his time with the Texas Rangers in the 1992 Donruss set. But first, as always, we like to talk about what you're talking about from our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, open 24/7. Looking forward to all the comments that we get, not just about our podcast, but about the hobby in general, or about some of the players that we talk about. And we have plenty of reaction from the 92 Donruss Triple Play podcast that we did this past Tuesday. Now, not enough reaction to the question that I asked, and that is, did Donruss Triple Play's marketing work? We mentioned it in the podcast that the Triple Play was created in the target of 5 to 12-year-olds, and this was for one of two reasons. First of all, because with the hobby becoming more and more of a business and an industry, there were plenty of critics who said, you're leaving the kids behind here. You're not making baseball cards for kids anymore. So can somebody please do that? So, there were some other little subsets that were made over the years, but Donruss Triple Play was one that was actually marketed for kids, and the price point was low, and the cards were kind of fun and goofy. Now, the other reason why Donruss Triple Play was made was, and I liken this to the fast food industry, the soft drink industry, even the tobacco industry, which is kind of a nasty relationship to have, but I said it anyways, trying to hook kids into doing this stuff at a young age in the hopes that they continue to do it when they're older. So I've mentioned fast food in particular. In McDonald's was accused of this for years. You know, the Happy Meal was the hook, and then when you got into your teen years, you're eating Big Macs, and then when you're much older, you're just eating all this other stuff that is generally not healthy if you don't live a healthy lifestyle. And that's what Donruss was trying to do here, was get kids to buy in early and be basically customers for life, although it's fair to say most of those kids outlasted Donruss during that time. And I asked the question, did this actually make you buy more cards if you were in the 5 to 12 age range in 1992? Didn't get a whole lot of responses to it. So either most of our listeners are on the older end of that scale, which could be the case, or nobody's listening to me, which is quite possibly the case too. And in that case, I'm quite impressed that you've gotten this far. But we did get some responses, one from Joey W., who I know is my age. You said, I was on the high end of being a kid, but I don't remember it being available much. It was never a big part of my collection. And, you know, card shops didn't really stock up on it because, again, it was a card that was nice, but it was not what the main core audience of the hobby was looking for. Of course, back then, they're looking for premium cards. They're looking for inserts. They're looking for gold cards and stuff like that. They weren't looking for kid-friendly cards there. So it may have been a regional thing, or Joey, if you shopped more at card shops as opposed to, say, a Walmart or a Kmart, then yeah, it may not have been a big part of your collection just because it wasn't brought up in front of you. Now, Joey does also show us a few pictures of the new Donruss Triple Play, and I should have mentioned this in the podcast. I mentioned that Panini revived the Donruss brand a few years ago, but they also revived the Triple Play brand. It's no longer Donruss Triple Play, it's just Triple Play. And he says that the current version is even more kid-friendly with eye black and stickers, 99 cents per pack at my local card shop. And, you know, these cards, yeah, like I said, I've never been big into the Panini baseball cards, regardless if they're branded Triple Play or Donruss, simply because I prefer the officially licensed stuff here. So you've got, you know, airbrushed out logos, and you know, you can't call the team the Toronto Blue Jays, it's just Toronto. You know, you can't call the team here in Tampa Bay the Rays, it's just Tampa Bay. You know, there's certain ways you got to get around it. But you know, the cards here are actually more they're definitely geared towards kids or big fans of anime or comic books. I mean, it's basically, you know, cartoon drawings of, and you know, some of the examples he has here, Derek Jeter and Alfonso Soriano, Kevin Youkilis, and yeah, I do see the eye blacks there, which, you know, of course are on the surface supposed to be intended for kids, but that itself turns into a collectible, much like, you know, the old stickers hockey packs from the late 1970s Tops used to put in sticker cards along with their bubble gum too. So yeah, it's really more of a collectible now than a kid thing, but I do kind of see where they're going with that. We also got an interesting reply from Peter Steinberg. I like Triple Play so much, I sophisticated my work ID card. And basically, he sent us a picture. We've got the work ID card, and on the back is a John Kruk Triple Play card that's basically been glued onto the back of the card there. And by the way, that is the thinnest that John Kruk has ever been. Kevin Hickerson, you find these in a lot of repackaged boxes at Target. Yeah, yeah, this is one of those early 90s card packs that you see. I made the mistake of buying one of those once, really out of curiosity, but also, you know, I was gullible. I saw, you know, prominently featured in the window part of the box, you could see probably six or seven packs of Topps Heritage from a couple years back. And, you know, if you've listened to this podcast before, you know I'm a sucker for Topps Heritage. So I'm like, oh, well, if I spend $20, I guess it was, I'll get all these Heritage cards. Now, normally it's, you know, $3 a pack or $2 a pack for Heritage. So 2 times 7, 14. Oh, so like the rest is bonus. Well, not exactly. I mean, it's a bonus, but, you know, consider what a bonus may be. There were a couple of 1990 Fleer packs, which, you know, I'm a big fan of 90 Fleer, so that was okay. That was kind of fun to open those up again. A couple of 91 Donruss packs, okay. And then I think the other six were just this BS Babe Ruth set, which promptly just went into the trash bag. It just wasn't really all that enticing. So yeah, you may get five or six of those more premium packs in those, you know, pack boxes these days, But you're definitely going to get four or five from the early 90s, and wouldn't surprise me one bit if Triple Play is included in there. Philip Hubert, actually responding to that question, did the marketing work. He said, I bought these at Value City in the 90s for $10 per box. Love them. You could probably still get them for $10 a box, or actually less. But you know, it was a likable product. Like I said, it was definitely geared towards kids or to, you know, younger teenagers. But it wasn't a big thing for the hobby. As I said, you know, hobby shops did not go out of their way to stock up on these because, you know, the hobby was changing. If this was something that came out in the mid-80s or early 80s, you know, much like the Topps big cards or the 3D cards, you know, the Donruss jumbo cards, I mean, those were kind of fun and definitely geared towards kids because, well, you didn't have a plastic sleeve large enough for those 5x8 baseball cards. But, you know, it was a good idea that just came at the wrong time because the industry was trying to, well, do that. It was becoming an industry. It was less of a hobby and more of an industry. And everybody wanted premium. Everybody wanted special cards and special inserts and special bells and whistles. They didn't want the kid-friendly stuff. So it may have worked for some people, in particular between the age of 5 and 12. And again, I was 14 when that set came out, and I still liked it. But it was not something that really overtook the hobby. Let's just say there weren't a whole lot of other companies that were eager to replicate what Donruss was doing with Triple Play. Although Triple Play did last, I know in 1993, and I think it went on for a few more years after that. So thanks again for everybody who commented on Wax and Gum Stains, our Twitter feed. Like I said, it's open all the time. You could talk about our podcast, the players we talk about, some of the teams we talk about, or you could just talk about the hobby in general. Always good to have the conversation going, always entertaining to see what other people are talking about at any given time. All right, let's talk a little bit about the 1992 Donruss set and our random pull again, card number 393, Juan Gonzalez. We'll talk a little bit about Juan Gon in a few minutes, but let's look at this card here because I remember when I first saw these, and I'm trying to think if I saw them at a hobby shop or a card show. I want to say it was a hobby shop. The first thing I noticed was brand new packaging. Donruss was one of the last sets to have wax wrappers. The 91 set was still in wax while a lot of the other companies were transitioning to, if not cellophane like Topps was, then certainly the foil packaging as Upper Deck had been doing for a long time. And also, you know, Leaf and Studio, you know, those premium sets were doing it for a while. Well, by 92, everybody was doing some kind of tamper-proof packaging. And I remember Donruss having not only the foil packaging, but a very unique selection of colors. Donruss 1, Series 1 from that year, was this kind of dark blue. It had this kind of a royal look to it, this and not royal blue, not like Kansas City royal blue, but it had this dark blue and gold, and it did have this kind of, ooh, this is high-quality stuff look to it. Series 2 had this kind of dark red and gold, which also had this kind of, you know, aristocracy feel to it. And I remember that was the first thing I saw was the packaging. I'm like, oh, well, this is different. And I bought a couple packs and I opened it up and I was like, wow, this is, you know, big time here. And Donruss really went for the premium look here. Now, if you look back at the previous sets from Donruss, in fact, even going back to 1981, Donruss often had a very basic, no frills look to their sets. Now, with that said, I'm not saying that they were bad, certainly not across the board. There were some that were pretty bland, but there were some sets that actually had a very good design to it. 84 is one that a lot of collectors think of off the top of their heads. I've always liked 85, 86, 87. I'm one of the few people that like the design of the 88 Donruss set, even though a lot of people hate 88 Donruss, 89 Donruss as well. And then, of course, the train went way off the tracks in 1990 and 91 with those designs. But they get back to business here in 1992. And I have to say, just on the surface, you know, when you open up that pack and you're looking at these cards, you're like, wow, these are really nice There's no more, you know, red with splotches of paint, 1990 look here. There's no more, as one of our listeners said, tacky Christmas sweater looks here like 1991. This was strictly business. We are cleaning ourselves up. Clearly, Donruss in 1992 finished up rehab after going off the wagon the previous couple of years. I mean, all of a sudden, this was straight edge. Donruss was not messing around anymore. So even though it was very sharp and very businesslike, unfortunately, in my opinion, I don't think it was enough. It wasn't as good as everybody else. And I know right now we're only about halfway through the 1992 sets, but trust me, you know, if you're not going to be able to wait through all the upcoming podcasts and you've got a stack of cards from 1992 just laying around your house, look through them. You know, 1992 Donruss is certainly an improvement over 91 and 90, and then you can make arguments, okay, 89, 88, etc. But is it better than Upper Deck that year? Is it better than Fleer that year? Is it better than Topps or Topps Stadium Club? Or even, you know, some of the sets that we looked at already, like Bowman or Leaf? I don't know. You know, in fact, ironically, because Donruss was owned by Leaf, it kind of fell in the same boat here, where it was a nice set, but it just doesn't jump out at you like, I have to have this. Now, again, in 1992, you looked at it and went, wow, okay, Donruss is all grown up. But in the grand scheme of things, not just in 1992, but here we are 25 years later, I don't know if it really holds up well over time. Now let's look at the design here, the front of the card. You've got Juan Gonzalez in mid-swing here, looking down a little to the ground, so it looks like he actually kept the ball out of the air and on the ground. But mid-swing here, a very good action shot, and I will say that Donruss had some pretty good photography in this set. You've got in this kind of baby blue streak up top, it just says Donruss 1992, and a rather boring theater marquee kind of look there. And at the bottom, you've got that same line treatment where the player's name and position is listed, and then his name in these kind of 3D-esque silver and black bordered outlined letters here. That's where his name was. So in terms of design, very, very simple. Donruss, even though they have notable space here for white borders, definitely going for less is more, which a lot of the car companies were doing starting in 1992. So the feature was the photograph. All right, here's the star of the card. It is the star, the baseball player. And then just a little room for his name and even less room for the team name, the position, and the Donruss brand. And again, you know, with 1992, not just the new look, but Donruss not plastering their logo everywhere. And that was something that you saw a lot in the 1980s with the competition heating up, first between Topps, Fleer, and Donruss, but then later as other cards were being made, you know, brands and logos were very prominently featured, not just on the front of the card, but on the back. Well, Donruss doing something completely different, just listing its name at the top as opposed to putting the logo. Now, the logo would be on the back, and the back of the card was the biggest change that you saw in the 1992 set, other than, you know, the standard stuff like cardstock and you know, wrappers and stuff like that. But ever since 1981, Donruss hung on to very limited stats, really nothing big on the backs of the cards. And the design of the card back for Donruss had basically stayed the same since 1982. And really, ever since 1985, it was virtually untouched. You know, from 85 through 91, the back of the card was pretty much the same, just different colors throughout the years. Well, in 92, they totally threw out the old drawing board and came up with this rather unique but also cluttered back, as you can see with our random pull here. So you've got the player's name in the upper left-hand corner. You've got his personal information right beneath that. You've got the Donruss logo right beneath that. Most notable of the back of the card is a full-color photograph of the player, which is very neatly integrated in with all of this other data. Unlike other cards, which were utilizing photographs on the back, again, Score was the first company to do it with the full-color photograph in 1988, but Upper Deck really, you know, set the mold for everybody else in using very large photographs on the back of the card. Well, Donruss just doesn't just drop a photo in there. It tries to mix it in with everything. So you see kind of at, Gonzalez's chest and his left shoulder. You know, the picture fades a little bit. It kind of bleeds into all the other stuff here. And I love this picture of Juan Gonzalez because the look on his face, this is the look you get when you fart on somebody's leather couch. Hey, you know, just want to, you know, talk about what I know about. But, there is just this really disgusted look here. You could, this was basically the base of a meme 25 years ago. So the disgusted look of Juan Gonzalez here is front and center on the back of this card. Right beneath that, you've got the recent Major League performance. And I need to correct myself. I said during the Donruss Triple Play podcast, I said that Donruss and Triple Play only showed the previous year's performance and the career numbers, and that is incorrect. So my bad there. Triple Play did that, but Donruss was still sticking with the recent Major League performance chart. And on the right-hand side, you basically have a column here where you have the card number, you've got the contract status, how acquired, and then a slew of career highlights. So it's a lot of the stuff that used to be on the backs of Donruss cards, and that is, you know, player name and personal information and card number, career highlights and stats. But instead of it just being in this nice, neat, almost library index card fashion, if you're too young to know what a library index card is, look it up. But, instead of this, you know, nice and neat, very orderly set up on the back of the card, it was just everywhere. So while there is a rather unique creation here of inserting the photo and moving things around to shake up the backs of these cards, it's very busy, very, very busy here. But at least you had, with the photos in there, it did add a little more life to it. And if there's one thing that Donruss just never really did well, even though you can give them an A-plus for consistency for all those years where they ran pretty much the same back of the card, it wasn't really worth looking at. You know, I can tell you, at least with Topps, it was fun to look at the backs of the cards, not only for the stats, but you would get some interesting stories about the players or baseball trivia. And of course, Fleer, I've always been a big fan of, you know, the little metadata, if you will, that they put on the backs of their cards starting in 1987 with the little graphs, you know, where a pitcher does his best damage, where a hitter hits the ball the hardest, you know, how does a guy perform before the All-Star break and after. So Donruss was always the most boring of all the backs of the cards for many, many years. 1992, they certainly changed that up. And I think they kind of overdid it. Like I said, there's a lot of stuff here, and it's just kind of all over the place. And for a guy in Juan Gonzalez, who at the time had only played in three major league seasons, even it's busy for him. Imagine the cards for the guys who had been around for just a little bit longer. So, again, looking at the card set, it's very nice. It is certainly an upgrade from previous sets. It is certainly, at the very least, where all the other sets were in 1992, and that was Chasing Upper Deck. But was it really a great card set? Not really. Like I said, I put this in the same boat as Leaf. And, of course, Leaf made Donruss back then. It's a good card. It's a very nice card, but it's not one where you go, I've got to have this. And this was one of those sets where, sure, in 1992, I bought several packs. I don't think I bought a box, but I certainly bought my fair share of packs. But when I did my great card purge many, many years ago to, you know, finally just unload a few thousand of them and get them out of my house, this was one of the sets that I didn't hang on to. You know, one of the stacks of cards that I gladly just put in a box and sold to a shop for a dollar for every thousand cards that I had. So, I managed to hang on to a small collection of stars and rookie cards from that time. So, you know, I may have 20 or 30 of these cards nowadays, and I'm sure a lot of other collectors from that time do. Now, because this is 1992, there's a lot of the product that is out there, so you could still get complete sets, factory sets, for about $15. You can get boxes. It kind of varies, actually. The boxes I've seen anywhere from $10 to $20, and you have jumbo boxes, and you've got rack boxes. You also have the standard, you know, quote-unquote wax packs, because, you know, they're not wax, they're foil. But one of the things that drove the Donruss product back then and still keeps it alive now is you had the Donruss Diamond Kings were no longer just part of the regular cycle of cards. They were, you know, reformatted into an insert status. So there were an average of three or four per box. So that keeps the value up. It was a little more limited edition than just putting them in the standard run and having them show up in every couple of packs in the box. But also you had some elite cards, some special foil cards, and also you had the Cal Ripken Jr. autograph cards, which were featured in limited edition. I want to say 5,000 cards. So there are still some floating around in packs today. So that keeps the value of the packs up a little bit. Not all that different from 1990 and 91 Upper Deck because of the autographed insert cards, even though the rest of the set is pretty much not highly sought after, really not valued that much. The autograph cards at least still give people a reason to go out shopping for it. Now, as for Juan Gonzalez, this is a guy who, again, had a very, in my opinion, tragic career. And it's not something, you know, he didn't get run over by a car kind of tragic, but a guy who started out with a great story and some great talent, and it apparently, not officially, well, at least according to him, got derailed with drug use, and that, of course, being steroid use throughout the 1990s and early 2000s. Juan Gonzalez was a member of the Texas Rangers for much of his career. In fact, he was a free agent signee, an amateur free agent back in 1986, very quickly moved his way up through the Texas Rangers Farm Club and made his major league debut at the tail end of the 1989 season. After that, I would say a cup of coffee in 1990, played in only 25 games, but in 1991, that was certainly his coming out party, hitting just .264, striking out 118 times. But when he connected, boy, did he connect. 27 home runs, 102 RBI, 144 hits that season in 595 plate appearances, and it would only get better from there. 43 home runs in 1992, 46 home runs in 1993. That would be his first All-Star appearance with the Rangers. He also participated in the Home Run Derby that year. That was the only Home Run Derby that he was involved in. But this is a guy who not only patrolled center field extremely well for the Texas Rangers, but you could drop him in anywhere in the 3-4-5 spot in the lineup, and he would deliver. In fact, having his best season in 1996, batting .314, 144 RBI, 47 home runs, he was the American League MVP in 1996. But wait, there's more. He did it again in 1998, hitting .318, 157 RBI that led the American League, 45 home runs, another All-Star season for him. He also had 50 doubles. This was a guy who could not only put the ball over the fence, but he had enough power to the alleys to where he got quite a few extra base hits, more doubles than triples, but he had a pretty good amount of triples, you know, three or four a year throughout much of his career. So I bet you a lot of people don't know that. If I asked you who was the American League All-Star, or the American League MVP, rather, in 1998, you know, you get kind of caught up in the Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa home run chase that you forget. It was Juan Gonzalez of the Texas Rangers. So he continues to have these all-star caliber seasons with Texas, but he then starts having this little prima donna stint here where he's upset that he's not getting invited to the all-star games. So he basically has a little pout fest around the 1999 All-Star game. So by the end of the 1999 season, the Rangers are starting to go through a rebuilding. The Detroit Tigers, who have just left Tiger Stadium, they need to bring in a big bat and a big name into their new Comerica Park. So November 2nd, 1999, the Rangers send Gonzalez along with Danny Patterson and Greg Zahn to Detroit for Frank Catalanato, one of my favorite baseball names. I always imagine the late Bob Shepard announcing that name. Now batting, Frank Catalanato. Also in that deal, Francisco Cordero, Bill Haslam, Gabe Kapler, Justin Thompson, and Alan Webb. Webb never made it to the major leagues, but certainly a few good pieces for the Rangers to build on in the major league level coming out of that deal. So it looks like it's a win-win. All right, the Rangers get some pieces to help kind of rebuild the team there. The Tigers get that big bat. Well, the problem is Comerica Park back in 2000, the first year it was opened, was, well, let's just say there was a lot of real estate there. It was definitely a pitcher's park, and it went against the grain for what new ballparks were being built for, because that was the same year that Minute Maid Park opened up in Houston, and that was a bandbox. That was also the same year that AT&T Park opened up in San Francisco, and you know, you had McCovey Cove, and everyone's hitting home runs into the bay. Well, Detroit was completely different. They had a huge outfield. So had the Tigers brought in Juan Gonzalez when they were still in Tiger Stadium, I guarantee you he would have had 50 home runs, just ringing him off of the porch in right field and deep into left field. But in Comerica, there was just too much space. He couldn't hit the ball out of the park as much as he did. He was also dealing with injuries for much of the season, so he only appeared in 115 games, but his power numbers definitely dropped. 22 home runs, 67 RBI, still hit 289, but his experience in Detroit was not a good one, so the Tigers decide to release him. Well, he signs with the Cleveland Indians in 2001 and has a career revival. Another all-star season, finished fifth in the MVP voting, 35 home runs, at 325 batting average. So after a great season in Cleveland, he has to move on as the Indians start tearing things down. So he goes back to Texas, and what should have been a really nice homecoming, well, that wasn't the case. He was dealing with a lot of injuries, played only 70 games in the 2002 season. In 2003, he played 82 games. What's really impressive to me, though, is that even though he put together only, you know, basically a half season in each season, he was still hitting in the upper 200s, you know, just shy of 300. And in 2003, he hit 24 home runs in 82 games. So imagine if he was actually healthy and was able to play 140, 150 games like he did earlier on in his career. I can only imagine the numbers that he would have put up. He would have been right up there in his early years in Texas, you know, hitting, you know, probably 40, 45 home runs once again. But even though it was a short-lived stay, and even though he had some success when he was healthy, well, in 2003, the Rangers start going through youth movement again. So he moves on again, goes to Kansas City, dealing with a lot of back injuries, plays a very limited 2004 season. Of course, the Royals not very good back then. And in 2005, he decides to go back to the Cleveland Indians, but the Indians only get one at-bat out of him. That's right, his first at-bat of the season. He's running out of ground ball, tears his hamstring. And I don't just mean tears the hamstring, right off the bone at the knee. So that was the 2005 season for Juan Gonzalez. And unfortunately for him, that was how his major league career ended. One game, one at bat, one plate appearance, a zero batting average, as an injury right off the bat, quite literally, completely derailed his season and thus his career. So it's a tough way for his career to end. He did play in 2006 with the independent Long Island Ducks, but wasn't able to make it back to the major leagues. Now, what makes his career tragic is he grew up in a very tough part of Puerto Rico. And it's one of those cities or one of those areas of a nation like Puerto Rico where if you don't get out, then you're going to die there. And you're going to die there either because of a lack of resources or a gangland death or drug-related death or something like that. So, you know, here's a guy, and like I said, his career mirrors Jose Canseco. It's so scary. You know, Canseco's family, if you listen back to her podcast on 89 Bowman, Canseco's family escapes Cuba. They settle in Miami. He gets a baseball career going, is basically the face of Major League Baseball until, you know, the early 90s. And then steroids enter the scene, and then Canseco's life ever since then has just been a circus act. Well, Gonzalez, same thing almost. You know, he gets out of Puerto Rico. He gets signed by the Rangers as an undrafted free agent, works his way up through the minor league system, becomes a star player in the early 90s, and unfortunately steroids got in the way as well. Now, even though Gonzalez is using the defense of, well, you know, you can test me anytime, you're not going to find anything, he was named in the Mitchell Report and also Canseco's book. He says, not only did Juan Gonzalez use steroids, but I injected him with them. And there's a whole lot of other circumstantial evidence as well including, his trainer saying, you know, I didn't have the drugs, Juan did, and Gonzalez saying, well, I didn't have the drugs, my trainer did. So that put a rocky end to that relationship there. But, there's all sorts of dark clouds and circumstantial evidence that does not help Gonzalez's case here. Certainly didn't help his case with the Hall of Fame. He had just over a 5% vote in his first ballot, second ballot, just under 5%. So he's off the ballot now. So if you're wondering where Juan Gonzalez is today, is he the circus act that Jose Canseco is? No. In fact, he is actually managing and owning his own team back in Puerto Rico, but certainly his career sullied by, not only the tough way that it ended on the field, but certainly all of the steroid allegations that surrounded it. However, back in the early 90s, I was very fortunate to watch Juan Gonzalez become really the first core player of that Texas Rangers team that would become a pretty decent contender in the mid to late 90s. Like I said, they weren't really, front and center until they made the World Series a couple times a few years back. But, you know, the Rangers before 1995, that team that was led by the late Johnny Oates, they were a laughingstock team. Of course, they were the second edition of the Washington Senators that, they couldn't do anything right in D.C. They move out to Dallas. They can't do anything right in the early days. There's a great book called Seasons in Hell, written by a guy named Mike Shropshire. He was a writer for one of the Dallas-Fort Worth newspapers back in the early 70s. He covered the Rangers from 73 to 75. And let me just say, there's some very interesting stories, not only about the players, but, Billy Martin was a manager there for 1 year when he was covering the team. Also, Whitey Herzog, who was, pretty much mentally on another planet back then. Their owner, Bob Short, was a whack job. There was all sorts of interesting stuff surrounding the Texas Rangers in the mid-70s. So it really wasn't until the late 70s that they became, what I called a C-plus team, a team that had some good players and some good moments, but could never quite put it all together. They were always kind of hovering around 500 for much of the first 20 plus years just in the Dallas region, never mind the 11 years that they spent in Washington, D.C. as the new Senators. But, seeing Juan Gonzalez patrol center field, just nail the ball every time he came in contact with it, and then to surround him with Ivan Rodriguez, eventually Jose Canseco, guys like Will Clark and Rafael Palmeiro. And then you did have some pretty good pitchers. Of course, Nolan Ryan was wrapping up his career, but, along comes a guy like Kenny Rogers and, of course, grumpy Kevin Brown. So, there were some pretty good pieces. Bobby Witt, too, he had a few good years with them. There were some good pieces that came along the way, and it was just kind of neat to see Juan Gonzalez before the steroid allegations, before he, had a rather nasty ending with the Rangers, kind of pouting his way out to Detroit. And the way that his major league career ended, I'm fortunate to see it when it began. It was kind of neat to see in person. So there you go, 92 Donruss, the good but not great set. Certainly a step up from previous sets, but kind of average across the board when it comes to all the other cards that came out in 1992. And Juan Gonzalez, an incredibly talented player who unfortunately made some poor choices when it came to steroid use. And even though he's not coming out and saying that he used it, there's a lot of evidence that goes against him. And that's what makes it tragic. Like I said, very much like Canseco's story, Canseco has a rough upbringing, is able to succeed despite, having to escape from Cuba. Gonzalez, having to escape from a very bad part of Puerto Rico, manages to do it successfully, but, lets it all go down the drain in the attempt to hit a few more home runs, get a few more million dollars out of it. And now, I hate to say it, but largely forgotten by baseball fans. Obviously, if you're a Texas Ranger fan, you know who he is. You remember him well. But a lot of fans in this generation, you still remember Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa and Jose Canseco and guys like that. But you don't really recall Juan Gonzalez. And that's rather unfortunate because he was a very talented guy, just made some very poor decisions along the way. All right, our next podcast, we're going to take a look at 92 Fleer. We told you about how Donruss had to raise the bar incredibly to catch up to Upper Deck in 92. Fleer certainly did that, not only to catch up to the competition, but to make people forget about that incredibly awful set that they released in 1991. So we will take a look at 92 Fleer, a set that I've always liked. I really liked it back in 1992. Still like it to this day, but does it fall in the same boat as 92 Donruss? Pretty good, but not as good as some of the other cards that came out that year. I'm starting to think, yeah, it was a nice set, but I don't think it was nice enough to really maintain the speed that the competition was running at. But we'll get more into that and do our random poll as well. That'll be coming your way on Tuesday. Remember, Wax Ecstatic comes your way every Tuesday and Friday via Audio Boom and iTunes. Tell a friend about it. Tell your friends about Wax and Gum Stains, our Twitter feed as well. And while you're doing that throughout the weekend, I will talk to you again on Tuesday. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for tuning in to Wax Ecstatic.